Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. It's February 5th, 2016, end of a long week, good productive week. And we are going to start with a public hearing on 4080. Adam, could you please read us the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4080 establishes the Governor's Foster Care Advisory Commission. It requires the commission to study specified topics relating to foster care and provide recommendations for legislation, specifies commission membership and rules, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. The committee is being asked to consider a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment modifies the name and membership of the commission, adds specificity to topics commission is required to study, and also declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay. Did you want to call Chip after you introduce?
Madam Chair, it's Mr. Senator Shields would like us to get him on and off the phone. He has responsibilities waiting for him, so we'll let him go first, and then I'll introduce the bill, if that's okay.
Okay, that's great. So first testifier is Senator Chip Shields.
Can you hear it?
Yeah. Chip Shields, how can I help you?
Hi, this is Representative Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, and you are live in the Human Services and Housing Committee. And we have a public hearing opened on House Bill 4080, and we're eager for your testimony.
Okay, well, mine will be brief. As the chair and some of the committee members know, my spouse and I have been foster parents for over 8 years. And I have been a board member of the Oregon Foster Parent Association for about 2 years. And I've seen firsthand how we really need to focus as a state on elevating the quality of fostering in our state to really make each Oregon foster home a true home of healing. I think this bill is a very important step in that direction, and I support it wholeheartedly.
Okay, great. Are there any questions from my colleagues here for Senator Shields? Okay, that's it. You got us off to a good start. Thank you for all your years as a foster parent and all of your efforts to have systemic change as well as the personal change that you've focused on. Okay, bye. What a great panel. Mm. Representative Stark, would you like to kick it off?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. For the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4, Southern Oregon, including Josephine and Jackson County. I'm pleased to be accompanied here by the Governor's Office, Danny, and Senator Gelser here. And really, we're here together to make a statement about foster care. Foster children are not a political issue. They're not a partisan issue. And we want to make a statement, both with this commission and by our work here in the building, that when it comes to foster children, that we care. That when it comes to foster children, that we are united. And we want to set a precedent with this bill and with this commission that going forward, we will continue to be united, both sides of the building, both parties, and the governor's office, because that's what our children deserve. So, I want to thank Senator Gelser. She's done a ton of work recently on the foster care topic. We've had all kinds of things going on, and she has been just relentless in it and her support in this. And also, Danny has been instrumental in the governor's office with especially coming up with some of the fine-tuning of the wording that I'm still getting used to. So, and then I also very much appreciate Interim Director Clyde Psyche for his support and his cooperation working through all of this. So before you do have some amendments. The -1 amendments is not the traditional gut and stuff that we talk about sometimes, but what it is we have reworded the bill to allow each section to flow smoother. And there are a few things from the original bill that we have changed and so forth, so I'll talk about that as we go through. But first of all, as we've seen, our foster children need our attention. Senator Shields and I had an opportunity to hold a couple different town halls throughout the state, and we had a ton of people who work in the foster care system come and report all sorts of fantastic ideas of what we should be doing to make the system better, to make it better on everybody involved, whether it's a biological parent, whether it's a child, whether it's the court-appointed special advocates, for the entire system. People had wonderful ideas on what we could be doing. And so I started working on this bill, actually almost a year ago, thinking of this concept of how can they have their voice be heard? How can these external stakeholders speak into one location? And out of that came the idea of this commission. So the commission, a few things specific about it, is one of the issues is the membership. Now, a lot of times when we put together a membership or a commission, we spell out really detailed what we want the membership to look like. This is one of these topics where oftentimes we have multiple moving parts. We might have a task force on one issue, like right now the Senate Bill 222 and child dependency. We have something going on that. We might have a work group like our external audit, taking a look at the Department of Human Services. We might have all these different groups going on. And so we wanted to make sure that we actually weren't competing with those groups in any way. And so we wrote this bill strategically to give the governor a lot of freedom with how she appoints members from these different areas. If you read the wording, it's including but not limited to, and then it goes through the list. The idea here is that it's external stakeholders involved in the system speaking into the system that can then advise the governor and the legislature on policy ideas, and also to keep a spotlight on the Department of Human Services and make sure they're functioning the best that they possibly can. We envision, biological parents on this commission. We envision, foster children on this commission. We envision foster parents, other advocates and volunteers, family attorneys, court-appointed special advocates. These are the types of people that we envision being part of this commission, because they're absolutely crucial, and they're the front lines day-to-day working on this. The mission of this, the Dash Ones are instrumental in this. The Dash Ones include some metrics, and this is where we didn't want to just say, hey, go out and take a look at foster care. That's a big task. And it's also a hard task to figure out, are they doing a good job? And are they successful in what they're doing? And so we went ahead and did another included but not limited to statement of all the different things that we would like them to be taking a look at. Reunification rates with families, and is there the proper demographics? Is that too much weighed one way or another? These are important things that we want to at least give a starting point, but it's in no way intended to limit what they look at. We want them to take a look at the foster care system in large and how we can keep it or make it perform even better. So that's the idea on the membership there. And then ultimately, that the governor can really kind of take a look at this and make sure she's hearing from these stakeholders and moving on. So a couple things I want to mention on that we have removed if you've read the original bill and only the original bill. The original bill had an accountability measure regarding subpoena power. We went ahead and moved that out. We figured for this time and season that might be a little bit stronger than we are going for right now. But we absolutely want this commission to have some authority. And in fact, one of the things we added in the commission is the idea that all these different groups that we have going on, where they do great work for a year or two, and they come up with some sort of report on what we might do, we don't want it to just hang out there in the abyss. In fact, they're all going to now report back into this commission. So the first line of defense, ideally, the first line of defense moving forward when it comes to legislation for the governor, for us, would be this commission, as they're going to collect the reports from these other groups. So that's the idea there. I'm very excited about it. Hope we move forward on it, and hope we stay united working for children.
Am I next?
I don't know.
Thank you, members of the committee, Chair Kenny Geyer, and others for your record. My name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath. It's a real privilege to sit here with Representative Stark, who is an individual that's such a champion for kids, for foster care, for excellence. And I'm very proud to call him a colleague and a friend. And, of course, Danny from the governor's office. As we all know, we've had a lot of conversations related to our child welfare system over the last several months. The governor and Representative Stark have been really key partners in looking at how we can make things better. And I just really, on the record, wanted to thank the governor, who has personally been engaged in these conversations. I can't count the number of times that she has called with an idea, and how committed I see her being to the well-being of Oregon kids. This commission that would be appointed by this governor gives me a tremendous amount of hope. One of the things that I've learned over the last several months is how much information is out there from the people that are actually experiencing the system, those who have kids that are in the system and trying to reunify, the children themselves, the caseworkers, the supervisors, the CASAs. All of these individuals see this work and the challenges on a daily basis and are ready to share that information if only asked. Last week, I met with about 20 caseworkers and certifiers. Tomorrow, Clyde and I are going to meet with a group of foster children and CASAs who've had some difficult experiences recently. I've been meeting with other caseworkers and CASAs and attorneys, and what's remarkable is how many of the themes are the same. And those that have the voice that's most powerful are the foster youth themselves. And to have a commission that is wholly focused on them, on the experience in the foster care system, which is much narrower than the child welfare system as a whole, is incredibly, incredibly important. Because even when we reduce the number of children in foster care safely, we will still have a child foster care system. And that needs to be not just safe, but it needs to be nurturing, and it needs to be helping kids to be the best that they can be so that they know that they are important. Having an entire commission focused on that sends that message. So I'm incredibly grateful to Representative Stark for bringing this forward. It is a great first line of defense, and it will make sure that our focus is always rightly on the safety and health of these kids and this system, regardless of what headlines might be in the newspaper that week. So thank you, Representative Stark and Danny. I hope you'll relay my personal thanks to the governor for her excellent leadership in this area.
Good afternoon, Chair Geyer, members of the committee. Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danny Ledesma, and I'm Governor Brown's Housing and Human Services Policy Advisor. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 4080. Governor Brown supports this bill for many reasons, and as many of you know, the governor began her professional career as a lawyer representing children in juvenile dependency cases. Through this experience, she gained the firsthand knowledge of the complexity and significant need in the foster care system. This deepened her commitment to ensuring the safety and well-being of the over 7,500 vulnerable children in care in our foster care system on any given day. To strengthen our system, Governor Brown has taken several actions in the past few months. She appointed Interim Director Clyde Psyche, who has already made several changes to address accountability, the culture, and practice at DHS. The governor also called for an independent review of the substitute care system and appointed an external review committee to oversee these efforts. The work of these two entities is underway, and additionally, our office is staffing the Children's Dependency Task Force that Representative Stark referenced earlier, which is responsible for recommending a model system of representation in juvenile dependency cases. We want to thank Vice Chairs Stark and Peluso for both serving on these committees. Vice Chair Stark is serving on both of these committees, so we want to thank him for that. And I think what's compelling to this bill for Governor Brown is that she really shares Representative Stark's vision for standing up a commission charged with studying and making recommendations to continue to improve the system. It's our shared hope that this commission will continue to shine a light on the importance of improving the system long after the work groups and task forces, which are currently in progress, have ended. Our office is also excited that this bill includes our shared recognition of the importance of stakeholder voices in efforts to improve the foster care system. Thank you for considering our recommendations, just a few, to add representation from Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes and those organizations that serve urban Native Americans as well. Our suggestions to include members of the bar with experience specific to juvenile dependency and members from the Judicial Department in consultation with Oregon's Chief Justice. Lastly, I want to thank you for working with us to root the commission in addressing foster care system outcomes, increasing safety, reducing disproportionality, decreasing time to permanency, and increasing access to culturally responsive services are among the governor's top priorities. We really look forward to continuing this work together. I think that both Representative Stark and Senator Gelser said it very well, and that this is a united issue. The children in our foster care system are all of our concern, and doing this work together is our great honor. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from up here? Well, I want to just say that's a fantastic way to start off, both with Senator Shields and then all of you, to show the importance. I know that two of you have been foster parents yourselves. You walk the talk. For Senator Gelser to be here working on this issue as well as her own bill that we will be seeing in the second half of the session, the amount of work that you've put into this, it really shows in this bill. It's a truly bipartisan, bicameral bill. And to have the governor's office weigh in, as well as the department, I think anyone who's been in this building for a while knows that that is extremely rare. So it's a testament to the incredible hard work and vision and integrity with which you have brought this forward, as well as the acknowledgement by all of us about the vulnerability of these children and how we need to do so much more to make sure that they're protected. So thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, not just bringing it forward, but bringing it forward in the way in which you did.
Thank you.
Okay. So next we have James Borda, Debbie Albright, and Scott Gallant. And then on deck will be Janet Ahrens, Clyde Psyche. And is there anyone else to testify on this bill?
I guess I'll start us off. Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is James Borda. I'm the legislative director for Children First, and I'm here to express my appreciation to Representative Stark and the governor for their commitment to improving the foster care system. I also want to express my unreserved support for House Bill 4080 and with the Dash 1 amendment. So we especially appreciate the continuing recognition of the importance of having a foster youth on this commission, as has already been mentioned by both Representative Stark, the governor's office, and Senator Gelser. During the appointment process, we hope there will be an understanding, and we understand there will be, that a four-year term is difficult for a foster youth to commit to. But this does not, we don't desire any changes in the bill. We think it's great. I simply want to put that on the record for the governor's office consideration. So we appreciate the work of the numerous stakeholders and promise to express any future input in a timely manner. And thank you for creating this panel that will create systemic change to improve the lives of foster children, foster youth throughout our state. Much appreciated.
Okay. We'll let him make a quick comment after all the work he's done on it.
Yes.
Otherwise, let's hold the questions for the panel.
Thank you, Chair. And I do want to make a comment that, you know, we fully recognize, I mean, we very much desire to see some foster youth on this commission, and we fully recognize that, you know, students, their life changes at a much different pace than adults, and so it will not be a surprising thing if someone's only able to commit to a year and then we need to appoint another youth. That is, I imagine that the governor is going to be very receptive to that.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Debbie Albright, and I am the president of the Oregon Foster Parent Association. I know some of you may think that Don Darland is still the president, but he lets me pretend to be and shake the hands and kiss the babies. So. I was a little nervous about coming today, and I was talking to my 8-year-old son, and he said, Mom, don't worry. They'll listen to you. You're the president of Book Club. I'm representing everybody here.
Just wait till he's 18. You be saying that.
So thank you for having me here today. I just wanted to share real briefly who I am. My husband and I live in Fall Creek, Oregon, which is in Lane County, and we have 7 children, 4 bio children, my adopted son, and 2 girls that we have guardianship of. We were foster parents for 7 years in Lane County, fostered over 31 children, and it was interesting when I was listening to the others speak I was thinking about how many children out of the 31 that I had that actually went home. And the number was low. It was about 4 out of the 31 children that were actually that actually went home to their biological parents. And that breaks my heart because I'm definitely an advocate of biological parents and reunification. I think we need to do better with that as well. I was the president of the Lane County Foster Parent Association for 3 years. And just loved the work and just feel that although the requirement for biological parents is minimally adequate, that should not be the requirement for us. We need to do better. Just a brief history of who I am. 2 years ago, we had a false allegation against our home, and my husband was removed from our home, and then subsequently our foster children were removed from our home. My husband was out of our home for 9 weeks while the investigation was conducted. He took a polygraph test and passed that 100%, but we still have a founded allegation of abuse. We will never foster again because of that, which is heartbreaking. And so you're probably wondering, why am I the president of the Oregon Foster Parent Association? And the reason is because I still believe strongly that we can do better, that my heart is for children, and we have to do better. Representative Stark mentioned the town hall meetings that we've conducted, and I can just tell you from being the president and being part of social media, we have about 700 people between a couple different Facebook pages, 700 foster parents. And what we heard from the town hall meetings and what we hear every day on the Facebook pages is just the cry of the people needing to be heard, mm-hmm. needing to be part of the team working together with the agency to in the best interest of these kids. It's heartbreaking for us to see kids move time and time again to not only be removed from their biological families, but then be removed from foster families and foster family and foster family. That was the heartbreaking thing in our situation. We were fostering a little girl who was 10. She had been homeless her whole life, and she'd been with us for a year. She was in school. She was playing soccer. She'd finally found that stability, and she was moving to her aunt's home. It could have been an easy transition from being removed from her homeless parents, being in our home with that stability, that couple of years before she got moved to her aunt. Her baby brother was born along the way. We had him for 8 months. And when those children were removed from my home, they were separated because there were no homes available to take 2 children in Lane County. So they were split for another 7 months before they went to their aunt's house. And as heartbreaking as the whole situation was for me and my family and devastating, we will recover because we are educated and we have, I can go to therapy, all of those things. But I feel that these children won't recover from this. And we have to do better. And I'm so excited about this bill because I really feel like it allows the voice of the people who spend every minute with these children, mm-hmm. sacrificing their families and their lives to in what's in the best interest for these children. It allows them to have a voice. I'm so thankful when Senator Gelser mentioned feeling hope. I feel some days I feel discouraged, but in the days that are coming up, I felt hope because of Governor Brown and just how involved that she is in all of this. And so I wanted to say thank you to her for being involved in this and actually wanting to hear from foster parents and foster youth, because we can make a difference. Thank you.
You certainly can. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Gallen. I'm representing Oregon CASA. Madam Chair, I've been in this process for a day or two. There are 5 sponsors of this committee on the bill. Obviously, the governor supports this bill as well, as does the Oregon CASA Network. It's very important that this move forward. So I will be brief. CASA, just like others, hope that the governor will seriously consider having a CASA representative on the commission because of their unique perspective, statewide perspective in this process. We believe that we can provide very positive, forward-looking solutions to the current system and appreciate Representative Stark's consideration for CASA Network in that process. With that, we support the bill. Appreciate all the work you have done and hope it moves forward quickly. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay, we have next Janet Ahrens and Clyde Psyche.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here today. I really have to say that with all sincerity. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits who take care of kids. That includes about 100,000 children, many of whom who have had foster care experiences. And through our members, we also represent about 200 foster parents. So we're very excited about expressing our support for the bill. And I also want to thank Representative Stark not only for the initiative and the thought and the energy that you put into building this bill, but because you're the right person to do this. You're a foster parent yourself. You've worked in a provider, a nonprofit provider organization who has therapeutic foster care. So you have a perspective and a demonstrated commitment and something really, really special that drives you, that's very, very connected to those kids, and that's a big advantage to us all. Thank you. Yeah. It kind of goes without saying that Oregon's foster care system is struggling a little bit right now. And there are, as you mentioned in your testimony, lots of people who are doing different pieces of work. And it's going to be really, really nice to have a central location where that work is going to be received and evaluated, and that there'll be some determinations made about what to do with all the information. And it's an opportunity to get rid of the dusty books on the shelf that we often see as the end life of work that people have done. I want to tell you a little bit about a study that the Alliance did that included foster kids. The ACE Adverse Childhood Experience that you all are probably well aware of. It's a study that was conducted by the Center for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente. They took a look at 10 adverse childhood experiences. It could be death of a family. It could be addiction. It could be a parent in jail. It could be death. It could be abuse, neglect, and those events. We looked at kids who were runaway and homeless, foster kids in the juvenile justice system, child welfare, who were in addiction recovery programs, mental health programs, excuse me a second. It upsets me to say this, but the kids who were in foster care had the highest ACE scores, and they're almost 8s out of 10. So there's a lot of work to do. That's very important. Okay. So now, the good news on the commission, it's going to have an opportunity to take a look at the short-term opportunities, but strategic planning, and that's the big piece. And I love that the governor especially is wanting to work with you on getting outcomes. We're really big, as you know, from some of the work that we were doing with Senate Bill 1515, that the outcomes have a targeted outcome. What is this going to do? What are you going to achieve? What's going to move the dial for kids? What's working? What isn't working? And I think that information that's going to come to the commission, like I said, the governor's interest in having outcomes, targeted outcomes, and measurements is really a very good piece of news as well. So I'm just waiting for the vote. Thank you.
So Chair Kenny Geyer, Co-Chair Stark, and Co-Chair Peluso, for the record, Clyde Psyche. I'm the Interim Director of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 4080. Chair Kenny Geyer, I think you mentioned earlier that it's not very often that agencies come out and actually testify in support of the bill. I had a chance to have a conversation with the governor, and it was a great conversation on Tuesday, and she said, yeah, get over there and testify in support. So I felt like I had my marching orders, and that's why I'm here today. But I'm also here because
as Danny mentioned earlier, the governor had asked for an independent assessment of the substitute care system in the state of Oregon and established an external advisory committee, and Vice Chair Peluso and Stark both serve on that committee. It's a very diverse group of people. It includes foster parents, foster youth, representatives from the tribes, the legal community, advocates, CASA, and just the experience with that committee has thoroughly convinced me the value of a commission of a diverse group of stakeholders and advocates, and something that really should not just be here for an assessment, but something that should be here on an ongoing basis. There has not been a meeting of that group that I haven't come out of the meeting and said, wow, I never thought about that in that way, or wow, we should really try that, or you know, I didn't realize that was happening. It's something we needed to look into right away. So very excited about the opportunity to working with this group to improve the child welfare system in the state of Oregon. And I also feel, finally, that two of the things that the group can help the department with, which are two things we really need to improve on, are transparency and accountability. And so I'm looking forward to working with the group and hoping that the bill passes. And with that, I'll stop.
That's great, Dan. Thank you so much. Any questions, particularly from Vice Chair Peluso?
No, I'm likewise waiting for that vote.
Okay, good. Okay, great. Thank you so much for your testimony. Well, that's a good way for me to say before closing the public hearing on this that this seems like one of those no-brainers that we should just go ahead. There's been so much advance work. We should just vote on it. But I try very hard never to schedule a work session on the same day as an initial public hearing. I think it's really important that people have the chance to absorb. And if there were things that got brought up that may or may not have made it into an amendment, like the tribes and legal community and other kinds of things, we want to be able to consider that option. So it is, I think, on either Monday or Friday. Monday, it's scheduled for Wednesday for a vote, and I also look forward to voting for that. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4080 and open a work session on House Bill 4001 and 4143. And the reason we're not having a public hearing is because you all sat through about 4.5 hours of public hearing on Monday on these bills. 4001 basically was the bill that was introducing, lifting the ban on inclusionary zoning and had some tenant protections. It also had a third piece allowing cities to waive building and zoning codes under emergency. We already struck that out of the bill. So what's currently in 4001 is the inclusionary zoning and tenant protections. And then you may recall 4143 is Representative Gorsuch's bill, which focuses on only on tenant protections. And today what we're going to do is have some of the people that were so patient and had signed up to testify and could not testify on that day, as well as somebody who did testify but was invited back to give some clarifying responses on the technicalities. Would you like to ask a question?
Yeah. Public hearing or work session?
So right now we're in a work session, but we're having some invited testimony. Okay. From people that were not able, so rather than opening up to anyone that wants to speak, we're inviting back the people, as I had announced on Monday, we're inviting back the people who didn't get a chance, they had signed up and didn't have a chance, or were asked to return to answer some technical questions. And I also have not given advance notice, but if any of the landlord associations want to address one of the amendments, I'm going to mention what we're looking at as being in the bill, because there's an idea that has come from the Landlord Association, and we didn't talk about it on Monday. So what we are looking at doing right now is focusing the tenant protections in House Bill 4143 only. We will strip them out of 4001, and we will deal with Representative Gorsuch's bill as the one that will have the tenant protections. We do not have the amendments ready. Even if we had the amendments ready, I would not have expected you to vote on them today. I was hoping they would be there so everyone could see them, so I'm going to try to summarize them. And also, just to let you know, inclusionary zoning is being worked on fast and furiously. And the 4001 still has the inclusionary zoning language in it. There will be changes in the inclusionary zoning, but it may be on the Senate side. So that is a vehicle that continues to exist for inclusionary zoning, but it may very well come from the Senate side. So we'll make a decision on what to do with 4001 next week. So really what we're focusing on primarily today is the tenant protections, but we did invite Kurt Krieger from Housing Authority in Portland to come back and answer some questions while they're fresh on your mind. I'm sorry that Representative Buehler's not here because he was the one that was asking some of those questions, but he can go back and watch it, the archived version, because we will be dealing with inclusionary zoning, and so while that issue is hot, I want to give you as much time as possible to hear the responses, because you may continue to have questions, and we don't want to stop the conversation while we're waiting for things to happen. So I would love to invite up first. Well, maybe I should invite up because you might be very quick.
Great.
John, yes. There were some people that were testifying not on technical questions, just your overall impression of the bill. John Bartholomew, there was one other person who had signed up and wasn't able to come, and I don't know if he came back.
He's not able to come back.
Okay. So, yep.
And I will be very brief.
Okay, great.
So, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, I am John Bartholomew. I am the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And we did provide written testimony in support of 4001 before, of course, the changes are, you know, being made. And just wanted to say why we care about the housing issues in general. And that is that seniors in Oregon, you know, overwhelmingly want to stay in their own homes, whether it's a rental or they own. And yes, there's a higher percentage of home ownership among older Oregonians. But that also means that those folks that are not owners are more likely to be low-income folks. And so the housing crisis is impacting them disproportionately. They're on fixed incomes. In fact, Social Security didn't even get a cost of living adjustment this year. And so any rent increase impacts them dramatically. But then when they're asked to move out, it's a lot more difficult to deal with it for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, they may be physically less able. If they have mobility issues, it's going to be very difficult for them to pack up and leave. Also, even just look for a new apartment to live in. And then their ability to do the move physically is going to be more difficult. And then the issue of being able to find a place that will work for them, given that they might need something that doesn't have stairs, doesn't have a tub, but has a walk-in shower. So accessibility issues are really key, too. And that really narrows down the number of places that are available. So having a little bit more time to look and make the arrangements, those are why we like the tenant protections that were in the bill. And then if they can't find another place to live, sometimes these folks are currently using home care services. They're Medicaid eligible using home care services. If they can't find another place to live where they can continue to do that, then they move into assisted living, which costs more to the Medicaid system. The inclusionary zoning piece is really important simply because it's an option for local municipalities to create a larger supply of affordable housing. And so those two things together are things that we're very concerned about at AARP and give our support for the principles that are moving forward in these two bills.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yep, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I have a few amendments that I'm hoping to have conversations about on House Bill 4143, but I'll ask you about one of them since you've mentioned senior housing and keeping seniors in your home. Where would AARP be on a low-income senior property tax freeze for people who are sort of on the margins in home ownership as part of a solution for senior housing or people not losing their home or maybe their assets tied up, but the problem that you just mentioned of, you know, pension fund or, you know, retirement pay not appreciating with rent, it's also not appreciating with property tax.
Right.
And so where would you be on an amendment that would look like that? I'm just throwing this at you. But
yes, I know.
It addresses the same issue, just a different class of people who are in the margins on their home if they're 150% or less of poverty.
Yeah. Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish. It's something we definitely take a look at. I know things get a little complicated when you have the senior property tax deferral program in existence. So I'd be interested in talking to you more about
it. On the 3% annual.
Right.
Just a total freeze for that group.
I would like to have more conversation with you about that, but I'm open-minded to it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Great.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Kurt Krieger. Thank you for coming back. And I hear you're going to be back here on Monday, so thank you for coming so often.
Yes. Kurt Krieger, Portland Housing Bureau. Since this is the City of Portland's top priority, I don't mind being here a few times a week. I heard three questions. There may be others, and my response to those three may elicit others, so I'm happy to respond to the first three. The first question I heard was actually directed to Chair Cafore about the universe of need. And as it turns out, the Housing Bureau prepares the consolidated plan for Multnomah County, the City of Gresham, and the City of Portland, for which we submit to HUD for federal funding. So we manage all that data anyway, and my staff have been doing that for many years. So the current need is 23,845 units, and that includes extremely low-income housing, very low-income housing, and low-income housing across the board. In addition, I would be remiss if I didn't say that the 2035 comprehensive plan for the City of Portland has been drafted. Public hearings have been held. The City Council is now deliberating on what parts of it to change before they enact it. And that contains an additional goal for 10,000 permanently affordable units. I believe it would be accurate to say that those two numbers together constitute our present day and our projected future need. So that's 33,845.
Kurt, can I ask a question? So 10,000 in the what's the projected future? Are you
that's
looking next
that's
two
a 20-year projection.
Oh, okay.
Between 2015 and 2035.
And 24,000 is the current need.
23,845 is the current need. 10,000 is a projected future need. So we're talking about 34,000 housing units. The second question I heard was what difference would inclusionary housing make in the City of Portland? So we looked back from 2010 at the building permits issued by our Building and Development Services Department. I must make a caveat that they've been so busy that for the year of 2015, they haven't actually issued the final numbers of the total number of permits they've issued. So we have numbers through August. And we applied a minimum threshold of 20 units just to contain the number of units and the 30% affordability requirement in the current draft, 4001. What that tells us that were that tool to be available in 2015, we would have produced 803 units through August. In 2014, for which we have a complete calendar year of information, we would have produced 1,210 units. In 2013, 707 units. 2012, 481. Obviously, the economy was just recovering. 2011, 230. And in 2010, we would have produced just 172 units. So that's a total of 3,603 units, or rounding up to 4,000, assuming that we have 4 months between August and the end of the year to include. And what that tells me in that period of time, if that were then projected 20 years, over a 20-year period of time, we could reliably estimate with business cycles, including booms and busts, to produce about 16,000 units of affordable housing. That really covers about 57% of the current need and the projected need. So it's not a panacea, and we've said that all along, but it is a major step in the right direction. And I must say that we haven't gone into actually creating the programs. There's lots of questions to be answered about the incomes of the people to be assisted, but those are the gross numbers. The third question I heard asked that deserves to be answered was how are tenants or homebuyers selected for these units? And I can tell you that how it works in Fairfax, Virginia, which is the last place that I operated these programs. These are still privately owned units. So a multifamily owner of property that has a requirement for affordable units will either manage those properties themselves or they will delegate the management to a private property management company. And because we will have given them something in return, that list that you have in 4001 includes tax abatement, includes fee waivers, there will be an agreement. And that agreement will stipulate what their affordability requirements are, and we will monitor those annually. So we will do an on-site inspection. We'll look at their tenant rent rolls, and we'll ascertain through quality inspections and quality assurance whether or not they're in compliance or out of compliance. That's for rents and for rental properties. If this were to be applied to home buyers, generally the same thing would apply. There would be a covenant or a restrictive deed on the affordable unit. A income-eligible household buying that unit may choose at some future point to sell it, and they would need to sell it to another income-eligible household, or there would be a recapture provision so that any public dollars that were invested in those units do not become a windfall profit for that individual. And while Fairfax County administered a list of income-eligible households that were waiting for those units, frankly, in Portland, it would be, I would advise that the city dedicate that passed to a nonprofit. There's a group called the Portland Housing Center, which is a HUD-approved home buyer assistance training organization, and there are others in Portland that do this work. I don't think we should be in the business necessarily of linking buyers together. That should be something that the nonprofits do. But we would still have an oversight responsibility, because having the restrictive deed means that we will be notified of any subordination request by the lender for a payoff. So we can respond to that in time, in a timely manner when that comes to us. And we can subordinate that interest that we have in the home as long as another income-eligible household buys the unit. If for some reason they're not income-eligible, we would not subordinate, and we would seek recapture of those funds. I hope that explains things in at least lay terms. And if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
That was very thorough. I will make sure Representative Buehler hears that. I wonder if you could just say something a little bit more. You were saying how if somebody gets home ownership through the program, then when the house gets sold again, the public dollars don't all travel with that person, they stay. Could you explain that part again
a little bit? In my long career, I've administered a few programs like this. There is usually a means by which owners who have invested in improvements to their property, as we all do, that they have an opportunity to capture that value. So if, for example, a household has put an addition on the home, they need to demonstrate that they've added square footage or added capital improvements to that house. And there's usually a recognition of that value, and you can deduct that out of the equity that they would normally owe to the public source. What we're trying to prevent is any sort of windfall profit that would inure to one particular household and deprive another household of a similar opportunity. And any sort of normal, ordinary wear and tear is certainly recognized. Appraisals have to be prepared at the outset. And if, for example, the market has dropped and the home is worth less, then frankly, there's a write-off that needs to occur, because we can't always assume that housing will increase in value. Sometimes it doesn't. We've seen that in recent years. So there needs to be that recognition and that reality. All we're trying to do is to preserve and protect the public interest in the real estate and make sure that people are not unduly enriched with that investment.
And share the resources. Mm-hmm. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Matt. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming back. I'm sure we will be calling you up again when we're actually considering a real amendment with exclusionary zoning. Right. Thank you. Okay. So before I get to John Van Landingham, I do want to just say some of the things about what it looks like is in the amendment now so that, John, you can focus your conversation on the things that maybe not as much on the things we're taking off the table and more the things that we are keeping on the table. And then if any of the landlord associations want to come up and say something about another amendment, that were something else that we're including in the amendment, I welcome you to. You don't have to, and I didn't give you an upfront notice, so sorry about that. That what is being written up right now for an amendment is basically three different tenant protections. So Representative Gorsuch had three different protections in his, and I had five basic tenant protections in mine, and they got merged. So in 4001, the one that I introduced, we had 1 year no rent increase in the first year. Then we had a 90-day no rent increase after the 90-day notification for rent increase after the first year. And then we had a 90-day notification period for no cause after the first year. And then we had a relocation assistance, 1 month for relocation assistance for people who are receiving a no-cause notice after the first year. And then we had a retaliation piece that strengthened tenants' ability in the court of law to in a retaliation claim. So those were the five that were in 4001. The three that were in 4143, Representative Gorsuch, he had the same... he had the notification for rent, 90-day notification for rent, that was similar. He had a 90-day notification for no cause, but his started on day one of tenancy, whereas in 4001, it started after the first year. His was a little more stringent. And then thirdly, he had fees if the landlord did not do the proper notification. So those are, I'm looking at my, do I have it right? So those are the five from 4001 and the three from 4143. In merging them, what we're proposing is that we have, again, the first year, no rent increase in the first year. Secondly, that came from 4001. Secondly, what's that?
Cell phone.
Oh, sorry, okay. Someone's talking to me. The second one is 90-day notification for rent increase after the first year. So that's similar to that was the same in both bills. And the third one is 90-day notification for no cause after the first year. So that came from 4001, not 4143, which started from day one. It does not have, it took out the extra fees for landlords who don't follow proper notification, which came from 4143. And, oh, thank you so much. And the other one, which is actually an amendment that Representative Bueller has presented and is online, is removing the 5% from the House Bill 4143 90-day notification, because the concern was, well, then people could do 4.9% every month. It doesn't really protect the stability that we're trying to find for tenants. So I hope that I was able to describe that. It's a merging of them, and it's those three, the merging of the tenant protections from the two bills, those are the three that we're having an amendment written up for. And in addition to that, there was a concern that in last year when we passed some landlord-tenant coalition bill, we inadvertently, and this is the part where I would love it if any landlord association person wants to come up and describe this more elegantly, but we made a mistake and we ended up with units that are now illegal because the state is imposing certain egress, and we want the local fire code to be able, as they have in the past, to be able to dictate what that egress must be. And so we have a situation where we have some inadvertently illegal units now, and we're trying to clean up the language. So when people see that show up, when this finally goes online, I wanted you to understand where it came from. And if anyone would like to describe that more, would you like to come up, Gwen? Thank you. So I'm inviting technical witnesses up at this point to help me out.
I'm no Mark Long, but...
Okay.
So, hi, Gwen Baldwin with Multifamily Northwest. And really, this is a coalition fix.
Yep.
There was agreement at Landlord-Tenant Coalition that a circumstance that was raised by the tenant advocates, particularly those around Portland State University, that you might have a situation where somebody had a house and they were renting their basement, and the basement wasn't a bedroom. Everybody agreed, but it got described that would not be a bedroom. It doesn't have a window as a secondary egress. And so we crafted language to basically say that, you know, you can't sort of cycle that if the student moves out and they get their rent and their deposits right away, which is current statute, that you couldn't just turn it around and rent to the next, young person or unsuspecting tenant. And so there were some increased penalties. And again, creating clarity, there had to be a second exit. But unfortunately, in writing it the way we did, it didn't anticipate or factor in code language that would say that obviously a place that's new, that is maybe multi-storied, had sprinklers and proper ventilation, is a state, you know, sanctified bedroom, suddenly became not a bedroom. And so that would potentially remove thousands of bedrooms from being appropriate. And that was nobody's intent. And so we have provided language that really addresses, again, the underlying concern, but doesn't do it in a way that has unintended consequences. So
that's great. There's a huge agreement. Thank you for, again, yet another great accomplishment by the Landlord-Tenant Coalition. It's worked for many years together and bringing this forward. And thank you for Representative Stark, since I know you funneled the idea through Representative Stark in order to be included somewhere in one of these bills. We thought it would be appropriate to put it in the tenant protection bill, and we certainly would not want to be taking units off the market when we're in this state of a crazy market. So
agreed.
Just wanted you to all know there's no question about that particular one. There's a lot of agreement. I wanted you to understand where it came from when you see the amendment finally come out. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Any questions? Okay. So, John, thank you for waiting so patiently. I know you had to leave to get your wife at the airport in Eugene. And I know you were hoping to go toward the end anyway to wrap up some of the technical things. So if you do want to say anything about the retaliation or relocation expenses, feel free, because you had prepared to talk about everything that was on the table. Now we're narrowing down to three, so I'm assuming you'll spend at least the bulk of your time talking about the three that are left and then being able to answer questions people might have about how cause, no cause, all of that works.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Van Laningham. I'm a lawyer with Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I've spent almost 40 years representing tenants on everything imaginable having to do with tenants. I've spent the last 25 years, a significant part of that time, negotiating and drafting landlord-tenant law in a coalition that comes, those bills come to you. That coalition has produced a consensus bill in every legislative session since the early 80s, except 1991, when we agreed to focus on money for affordable housing. I, at this point, estimate I've probably written a third to a half of the Landlord-Tenant Act, which is Chapter 90, including the egress statute that Gwen Baldwin just pointed out needs to be fixed. So sometimes I get it right, sometimes I don't. I'm a tenant advocate. That's my job and my passion. That doesn't mean that I think landlords are bad or greedy. This is a relationship that only works if both sides are healthy. There will be no tenants if there are no landlords. We do not want landlords to fail. We want landlords to be healthy and successful. At the same time, we want tenants to be healthy and successful. And I think you've heard a lot of testimony indicating a concern that tenants in many parts of Oregon are not healthy. We agree that the long-term fix for that is to increase the supply. I'm working hard this session, as in other sessions, to address that, both with funding and with land use measures that might help with that. But those are long-term fixes. And we think this situation requires some modest short-term fixes. I would love to talk about retaliation because I feel very strongly about it, but that's off the table, so I won't. Plus, it's late. But let me talk about the three that are left on the table. The 90-day no-cause notice, the 90-day rent increase notice, and the provision for no rent increase during the first year. And I would welcome questions however you want to do it. The 90-day no-cause notice during the first year, keep in mind that the current law in Oregon already is a landlord can give a no-cause notice on a month-to-month tenancy, and the majority of tenancies, in our view, are month-to-month tenancies. Either side can terminate on a 30-day no-cause notice in Oregon. After the first year, this was negotiated through the coalition, a landlord can terminate a month-to-month tenancy only with a 60-day notice. It's a concept that we borrowed from California. There are some exceptions. For example, if a home is being sold, somebody's going to live in it. But the concept is you learn in the first year whether people are bad apples. And if you want to use a no-cause notice, you can do that. The change here would extend the no-cause notice after the first year from 60 days to 90 days. Seems to us that that's not a big ask of landlords. You might then say, well, what's the big deal for tenants? I think you heard testimony on Monday from people who tearfully talked about their inability to find another home after living in an apartment in Grants Pass for 5.5 years within 60 days. And she felt that another 30 days would allow her to find a place. We want her to find a place. Bill does not prohibit the use of no-cause notices. There's been some misunderstanding about that. The bill does not prohibit the use of no-cause notices. I've given staff to put on OLIS a list of all the kinds of termination notices that Oregon law allows. There are 12 different kinds for all sorts of things, including no-cause termination notices. This is not the only basis. There are quicker notices as well, 24-hour notices for threatening or outrageous behavior like drug dealing or prostitution, 72-hour notices for non-payment of rent, 10-day notices for having an unauthorized pet, etc. So if you're curious about all those notices, they're there for you to see. Let me talk briefly about the 90-day rent increase notice. Current law is 30 days. Current law allows a landlord to raise the rent at any time during the tenancy. It doesn't have to be at any point in a month on a 30-day written notice. John DiLorenzo argued on Monday that that's rent control. I disagree. I bothered to look up today the definition of rent control and found a lovely handout from the National Multifamily Housing Council on rent control fact sheet. Rent control laws set a ceiling on rents and severely limit or prohibit property owners from raising rents. Rent control laws are a regulatory scheme in which some agency, a court or an administrative agency, decides how much a landlord can raise the rent and when, or even whether a landlord can raise the rent. This is a notice requirement. It does not limit the amount of a rent increase. It does not limit the frequency of a rent increase. A landlord could raise the rent with a 90-day notice, if this passes, for any amount in the world, at any time, except during the first year and the third point we'll talk about. But this is not rent control. This is a notice requirement. And the point of it is to give a tenant who's gotten a rent increase, and you heard a lot of stories, you've received emails and letters about a lot of people who've gotten significant rent increases. I just saw a news report this week that said that Portland rents have increased by 63% over the last 7 years. That's huge, 63%. This home prices only increased by about 15, 16, 17%. So if a tenant gets a significant rent increase, this would not prohibit a landlord from imposing a significant rent increase, but it would give the tenant time to either figure out whether I can afford that or whether I need to move. And if I need to move, the time to find a place. The third part of this package, one other point that John DiLorenzo made. John DiLorenzo cited 91.225 in arguing to you. 91.225 is your statute, which preempts rent control. it preempts local governments from adopting rent control. It does not preempt you. You wrote 91.225. You could do whatever you want with 91.225. It only preempts or prohibits local governments, cities and counties, from doing rent control. You can do whatever you want. But again, this is not rent control. This is a notice requirement for any amount of rent that a landlord wants to charge, whenever and how often the landlord wants to charge. The third thing is the no rent increase. This idea, frankly, was suggested to us in negotiations with landlords by a landlord leader whose position was that would be bad business practice to raise the rent within the first year of a tenancy. It's a bait and switch argument. It doesn't happen that often, but it does seem to happen sometimes. And an example seems to be with college students who move in, get settled, get a big rent increase. They move in thinking the rent's going to be X, boom, they get a rent increase. There's no defense to that. You can't stop that. Your only choice is to accept it or move. I would point out to you that we already have the same concept with security deposits in Oregon law. 90.300 sub 5 sub A prohibits a landlord from raising a security deposit for the same reason, bait and switch, during the first year of occupancy. There was an issue identified in the testimony by one of the landlord leaders on Monday. We want to make sure that that first year of occupancy is not re-triggered when somebody new moves into the household. We've been working with the chair on the amendments, and we believe that we have fixed that, and we're committed to fixing that. That's not our intent. So those are the three things that are left. I'd be glad to answer questions.
Other questions?
Yes, Representative Pierce.
Thank you. And well, first of all, I know you do a ton of work on this. I've sat in those meetings with you for a long time now. And so I really do appreciate the passion and the commitment in which you come and try to bring find common ground solutions. And I think that's really important, is that everybody up on this, everybody up here wants to solve this. The question is how.
Right.
I have a few other amendments that I am hoping to bring forward, and I'm sorry that they weren't all uploaded. There was a little bit of maybe on my end or something that they didn't get there, but I did. It's on me. One's still in drafting, okay. And one's not even for this bill. It's in a different bill, but I did want to at least bring up. So you mentioned those sort of like, how do you get the existing supply, which I think you'll find most of us up here on the, you know, the right side of this are politically are about the supply side. We really believe that there is not enough space or land or whatever. One of the amendments that that I'm asking for is particularly for churches and nonprofits. In my community, I've got really big mega churches who are on 5-acre parcels across the street from really good schools, and all they have is church. And one of the churches, although I have not talked to them about this, I at least want to give them a tool to go back and have a conversation after this session. You've got a 5-acre parcel of land, you run the food bank, and you're across the street from some of the best schools in the state. How do we put some ADU-type units on your property right now so that we can solve some of this issue? That would be an immediate thing we could do on the supply side. Representative Nathanson is working on a bill about the lodging tax, and I asked her this morning if she would be open to an amendment to the lodging tax bill that would allow that if you were homeless going to a motel in Oregon, you don't pay state lodging taxes. We would put more cash back in people's pockets who are in transient housing. Could we do that right now as an immediate thing that would change the conversation? And then my county, Clackamas, is actually asking for an exemption or a deal to override sort of state statute, if you will, around disabled veteran housing, which particularly for the homeownership homestead exemption, they want to be able to set that at a local level, particularly if they're dealing with people who are severely disabled, and right now they're limited to a certain amount of exemption that they're allowed under the statute. So I have an amendment as well to do that, because my county wants to make that decision locally at the, because we have a huge portion of disabled veterans, probably higher than some of the other counties in the state. All of those things, I know I'm throwing them to you last minute, but those are sort of supply side or keeping people in their homes before they leave, thoughts or, you know, ability to sort of get on board with some of those types of things. Because I think we want a nice, good, comprehensive bill, but it has to balance, and it can't just be, you know, the sort of what I feel is a pitting of landlords and tenants who are mutually need each other. And I would really like to look at the more macro environment to solve these problems.
Chair Kindergeyer and Representative Parrish, I actually have seen one of your amendments, the dash one.
Yeah, and the dash, there should be a dash two that's going to get posted, and then dash something that's coming.
I haven't seen that one. And I'd be very happy to talk to you about any of those issues. Just a little background. besides being an affordable housing advocate and landlord-tenant lawyer, I've got a land use background. I served for 12 years on the City of Eugene Planning Commission, and then I served for 12 years on the state equivalent planning commission, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and I was chair for the last 7 years until 2012. I'm sorry that Representative Bueller isn't here so they could whip me about the head because I was the chair when LCDC rejected Ben's urban growth boundary, last urban growth boundary proposal. We're hopeful that it's going to pass and it's better. I'm a big believer that the land use program can be improved and should be approved to address housing issues. I'm also a big believer that it's complicated as hell, and making those changes is going to require a commitment to sit down with all the sides and figure out what those changes should be. I don't think they'll practically happen without that kind of effort to get people to understand what the issues are and what the changes could be. I'm open to all those changes. I would actually like to see a small work group. I've had these conversations with the realtors, lobbyists, one of whom I think is in the room, with John Chandler, with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, with the Natural Resources Director. So I believe in this issue.
So can I follow up?
Follow up.
So inclusionary zoning has been in front of us for several years, and the issue is local control. So in the case of asking my county, saying, hey, we would be willing to work on our local land use issues and follow all the regular land use codes, and I pitched this to one of my county commissioners, she's like, great idea, go for it, go put anything in there that gives us some additional flexibility. So pitching inclusionary zoning as a local control, but land use should be a bigger statewide conversation, lots of stuff, why wouldn't we let some local control flexibility with a very narrow range, property that can't be sold is what the amendment says. I'm sort of struggling when people say we want local control, but then over here, this is not a local control issue. And either we are local control or we're not, and we use that a lot to get in or out of why we support something. I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Chair Kenny Geyer, I'm Representative Parrish. You won't get an argument from me.
So what I would say about this is that I think we all agree that we need more supply. You have a question too? Well, let me keep going on the spot and then and invite you to join in. We all agree that we need more supply. There are a number of bills bills and budget requests that are in that direction. We have a $17.5 million budget request for preservation of affordable housing, which allows nonprofit groups to come in and buy and renovate affordable housing when the HUD contracts have expired. We have the capital gains tax exemption bill that came out of this committee that will be heard next week to allow when private property owners are selling apartment or something like that that came out of your ABC committee to Housing Authority or to nonprofit CDCs, they could get a capital gains exemption. So we'll incentivize moving private property over to affordable housing, private housing or market rate housing over to affordable housing. We have a dock fee that probably will not go anywhere this time around. Not enough time for discussions, but we should consider it in the future. Increasing the document recording fee that goes to Housing and Community Services to be used for affordable housing for single family homes, multifamily homes, as well as emergency housing. So we have several different ideas on the table. I welcome all these ideas, and the reality is we're in the middle of a session, and we're trying to narrow, but I think I'm still willing to look at all of yours, and I did want to invite you to discuss any of these. And the land use, we have land use bills as well, looking at whether Representative Stark has a land use bill. So there are many different ideas that are worthy of consideration, and I think despite all of that, we need to do as much as we can reasonably, balancing all the different needs to increase supply. In the meantime, it will be a long time before, even with what you heard what the City of Portland said with everything it's got on the table, even if we were to pass every single inclusionary zoning, land use, every single bill that was out there, it would be a long time to catch up on the growing gap that has happened over the last 35 years. And in the meantime, we now have a growing population of people who are renters, 40% in Oregon, 49% in Portland, and those statistics continue to grow. And when many people lost their homes in the foreclosure crisis a few years ago, they got bought up by others, whether they were mom and pops or whether they were big hedge funds. The reality is we have fewer homeowners and we have many more renters. And that is practically half of the population of Oregon who at any point can receive within 30 or 60 days a no-cause notice, and they must vacate the premise with their entire family, or within 30 days might get a rental increase that they can't afford. So that is the situation that we're facing in this particular bill. So I don't want to get too much into the whether all the other bills should pass right now, but this particular bill, we do want to come back on Monday with an amendment. And I think that Representative Buehler's amendment, which I think is the dash six, will get incorporated into that because we had the same idea as that. And as soon as I can get that amendment out, we will post it, and we're hoping that it's done today so that everyone has a fair chance to see it. And if there's a fair chance to see it, then we will try to move it on Monday. And if it ends up being too short of a time before it gets posted, even if it technically hits the hour, even though I've told you about it, we may hold it over to Wednesday. I do not want process to get in the way. I want a fair discussion. We had a really good discussion, long discussion on Monday about the tenant protections, and we will continue to have ongoing discussion about inclusionary zoning as well as the land use bills, as well as the other ones that are out there. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kingair. I've been looking into this issue and have been approached on it multiple times. I have a question that I think you might be the appropriate person to answer. In the state of Oregon, we have multiple, as you mentioned, 12 eviction notices or no cause or ways to move tenants out of houses. So if you could explain, after I ask my question here, my question is, my understanding, and it could be incorrect, my understanding is that those are separate notices that a landlord can file. One of the concerns that we listen to in testimony is if the no cause goes to 90 days, that tenant may have more inclination not to pay the rent. And then my understanding is that the landlord then has to go file a different type of eviction notice. We were told that was 28 days. You're testifying that's 72 hours. I'd like that clarified. And is there anything that prohibits if we went with a 90 days after 1 year, or another suggestion was after 2 years, but if we went with a 90-day no cause, is there anything that would prohibit us from saying, okay, it's 90 days, but for failure to pay to protect the landlord from a tenant that may just say, hey, I've got my no cause, I've got 90 days, I'm not going to move out, I'm not going to pay, for that notice to automatically become a different type of notice without requiring the landlord to go and file a separate notice, meaning that, okay, would it be possible to have a no-cause 90-day notice that says right in that notice that this will convert to a for-cause eviction notice for failure to pay in X amount of days?
Chair Kinnegar, Representative Hayden, that's a bunch of questions and a bunch of different concepts. And not to put you off, I'd be glad to talk more because I don't know how detailed you want my response to be. Here's how a 72-hour notice non-payment of rent works. And just to start by saying, that's the predominant basis on which tenancies are terminated. There is no statewide summary of terminations, eviction lawsuits. Eviction lawsuits are called FEDs, forcible entry and detainer. It's an old English concept. They're done in the county courts or in justice courts. In our county, that would be Florence and Oak Ridge. Mm-hmm. There's also one in Springfield. But nobody compiles the data to say, okay, last year, except countywide, last year there were 57,000 FEDs, and 90% of them were non-payment of rent. But if you ask practitioners, they will say to you, practically, we think the large majority of FEDs are for non-payment of rent, and the large majority of those go by default, which means the tenant doesn't show up, the landlord wins automatically. So here's how the timeline works. To use a non-payment of rent notice, the law says the rent cannot be due sooner than the first day of the month. That's because there was a landlord that used to make the rent due on the 25th and then charge a late fee when you paid on the 1st. One of our good Lane County landlords. So if you don't pay on the 1st, the landlord has to wait. You have 7 days of grace. So that's your grace period. Landlord can charge a late fee if the tenant doesn't pay by the 4th day. On the 5th day, the landlord can charge a late fee. There's a cap, but it's not really a cap. It's whatever the local custom is on the late fee. So landlords can charge a late fee if you don't pay by the end of the fourth day. After the 7th day, if the tenant hasn't paid, the landlord can file an eviction law, can file that notice, can give, excuse me, let me say that differently. The landlord can deliver to the tenant a written notice. That's the 72-hour notice. So let's say now it's 9 a.m. on the 8th day, and we'll just say it's the 8th day of February. That notice says to the tenant, in essence, you haven't paid the rent. If you don't pay within that 72-hour period, I'm going to file an eviction lawsuit against you. The tenant can cure that for-cause notice by paying within that 72-hour period. After that, the landlord has no obligation to accept the payment, even if it's a full payment. Some states are more generous. So that would take us to what, the 11th? Mm-hmm. If the tenant hasn't paid or left, those are the two choices. The tenant can cure by paying or leaving during the 72-hour period. The landlord can file an FED. How that timing works varies from county to county. In our county, Lane County, if you filed that FED on the 11th, and I can't figure out right now what day of the week the 11th is, maybe somebody could, the tenant will be served by the sheriff with a summons to court the next day, the 12th, and told to come to court a week later, the 19th. If the tenant doesn't show up on the 19th, the landlord gets a court order that the landlord can then use to forcibly remove the tenant. The sheriff does the work. Removing tenants can be dangerous. Sheriff, so that's why we have the sheriff do that work. It's one of the few lawsuits in which we have the sheriff enforce the judgment. So 4 days after that, I should also say, tenant can show up. Sometimes does, very rarely. Tenants, it's hard for tenant to get a lawyer. All right. Outside of Portland, there are very few private lawyers that do these cases other than legal aid. There's a legal aid program that serves every county. They're grossly understaffed. But let's say the tenant shows up in Lane County on the 19th and asks for a hearing. The hearing will be 2 days later, on the 21st. Tenant loses the hearing. The sheriff's order is 4 days. That'll take us to the 25th. So the timing can vary from other counties, some quicker, some slower. Coos County is much quicker. I think Multnomah County is some slower, and maybe that's where the 28 days came from. But so that's roughly how long it takes to actually, from the date the rent is due to the time the sheriff shows up and knocks on the tenant's door. If the tenant is still in the unit, the sheriff will remove the tenant. If the tenant goes back in, that's trespass, it's a crime. It's not a crime up until that point. It's the fastest lawsuit in the world. I realize that landlords are out rent during that month. So that's the timing issue. Could you convert a 90-day no-cause notice into a 72-hour notice? practically, could I write that? Maybe. I don't know that if I were a landlord, I'd want to do that because there's a lot of variables in there. If you're a landlord, you want certainty and you don't want to end up in court having a judge say, well, you didn't dot your I's, cross your T's here. But it would be possible to do that. Do I think that's a problem that needs to be addressed? I don't. We already require 60-day notice after the first year for no-cause notices. I don't believe we've heard a lot of horror stories from landlords saying, my tenant has stiffed me on the rent because it's a longer notice period. They want the tenant out. If the tenant leaves early, fine. I'd also remind you that there is no cap on security deposits. If you want to charge a 3-month, last month rent security deposit, you are free to do that. The only limit on security deposits is the market, you know, what the market will bear. So if a landlord is concerned about that risk, the easiest way to address that would be to have a higher security deposit or last month's rent deposit. And if the tenant doesn't pay rent, use that? That's a long answer to saying that. I'd rather not.
Well, it was a long question. It was a long answer. But it just seems like there are, thank you, Karen. It just seems like there are a lot of actions both required of the tenant, of the local county sheriff or state police or whichever engages with that, of the landlord. It just seems like there's a lot of pieces here that, is it possible to simplify it? Maybe the answer is no, it's not.
Chair Kennegeier and Representative Hayden, at the risk of having somebody say to me, well, then you shouldn't be supporting these proposals, that's complex enough that if you ask, the coalition would address and see whether there's a way we could make it work and horse trade to get there. Generally, tenants are reluctant to have 72-hour notices, non-payment of rent notices, move any quicker than they already do because they seem awfully quick to tenants in terms of litigation. It's the idea of you're going to get a lawyer and prepare for a trial in what's essentially 5 days is crazy.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kennegeier. So I'm not sure if I'm asking you or perhaps you or someone else, but so of course this is a very interesting discussion, and I was wondering if someone, if it came up in your work group or maybe you could discuss at the, are we at risk of an unintended consequence of landlords then increasing
deposits,
security deposits, because I don't have any data in front of me, but I'm going to go ahead and use some common sense that if we're trying to help those who are, you know, in the need of the most help coming up with 2 months' rent as a deposit or whatever it would be, that could be a challenge. And I was just wondering if that came up at all.
Well, I will say from my perspective, I've only been in this for a few months, and I was in work groups, and we talked a lot about unintended consequences. And certainly some unintended consequences can happen, and certainly some landlords said, well, then I'll be tempted to do that. So I think we can't categorically say there won't be some unintended consequences. I'm curious to know when you went from the 30-day to the 60-day, whether you saw deposits, you know, increasing, if there was a trend in that direction or if they significantly increased. I would think that people would not want to stop paying just because they're angry that they got a no cause, a 90-day instead of a 60-day. Like, would that make any difference? Right now they're getting more time than they would have. They're going to have something on their record if they end up going to court. So that seems like a pretty extreme move. Like, I'm angry that you gave me, and in this case it's more generous to do 90 than 60, so I would think that would have mitigated in the other direction. They'd be less angry than they might be now under our current law. So I think it's, you know, I want to let you answer that, but I know that we talked a lot about the possibility of unintended consequences, and the tenant groups that we talked with felt very, very strongly that these three measures, as well as the other two that we had, were going to make significant improvements in their lives, even though we weighed out all of those things. Well, there's the possibility that they're going to increase rent in case, you know, there's all those things that people have said, and they felt very, very strongly that they thought that on balance this was going to do tremendous good and add stability to people's lives, even though you can't preclude that some of those things might happen. But John, you had so many more years. That's what I picked up in our conversations when we're trying to come up with some very, very modest protections that would lead to stability.
Chair Kennegeier and Representative Taylor, so the coalition negotiated the extension to 60 days. So the current law is 60 days after the first year for no-cause notices. Coalition negotiated that. I have not heard stories by landlords saying that that they've had a particular problem with tenants not paying rent. I haven't heard stories from tenant advocates saying that the landlords are charging double the deposit that used to charge. I believe that landlords charge a deposit that the market will bear. Did we discuss it leading up to this short session? No. The coalition has not met. The speaker and Representative Kennegeier called a number of players together, the landlord leaders, the tenant advocates, me and Sybil Hebb, Janet Burr from the Housing Alliance, the realtors and the home builders, to talk about development issues and landlord-tenant issues. And the landlord-tenant folks had, I think, three meetings. And I would characterize them as not being productive on the issue of no-cause notices. So we never got to the point of talking about some variation on no-cause notices. There are always going to be problem tenants, and I don't know how to guard against that. There are tenants who get a termination notice and trash the place. There's no way to guard against that other than a deposit. Most tenants, however, are responsible and want to get a good reference from their landlord, because the next landlord can call that landlord up and say, did this person pay? And if not, that's a basis for denying that person and a good reason to deny it. We haven't heard, that's a risk that is there. Did we discuss it? No.
Although I will say I discussed it with Community Alliance and tenants and others, what might be the unintended consequence. And despite not being able to guarantee that there wouldn't be some landlords that would react in that way, they still felt that this was really important protections in this kind of market.
One
yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. One more question. And I haven't explored this maybe as much as the other question, but in your experience, when a landlord does increase rent, is there any tie to, for example, if a school levy or a fire levy or something is passed by the voters or the legislature or a change in property tax, are rent increases in contracts currently that tie to any of that? You know, like on the commercial side, you might have triple net lease or something like that. I'm more familiar with that, not as familiar with individuals. But is that an issue that should be addressed if there is a change in the responsibility for the owner of the property to pay X taxes and those X taxes change or that responsibility changes outside of the control of the landlord, such as a school levy or something, which would potentially, in a triple net lease, trigger a change in the next month's rent for that business. Are those common or potentially out there for person to rent a home?
Chair Kindergeyer and Representative Hayden, so keeping in mind that under Oregon law, even with this bill, after the first year, a landlord can raise the rent by any amount at any time in a month-to-month tenancy, which is the large majority of tenancies in Oregon, with a 90-day notice if this passes. So I suspect that you're going to have at least 90 days notice of your school levy passing, and you get a tax bill from the county that tells you what your taxes are, that gives you some lead time as well. There are fixed-term tenancies where people commonly call them lease. We don't use that term in Oregon law. But a fixed-term tenancy has a fixed start date and a fixed ending date, and the landlord cannot unilaterally raise the rent in a fixed-term tenancy. Neither side can change the deal unilaterally. So in a fixed-term tenancy, a landlord can't give a rent increase notice. But some of those do have provisions that call for a rent increase, say, annually on the anniversary or something. But I believe the law says that they have to be tied to another figure. It can't be subjective with the landlord. So if it's, say, for example, every year I'm going to raise your rent by X percentage or by the CPI, or something specific like that, I think they can do that on a fixed-term tenancy. But again, we have some disagreement within the coalition about how common fixed-term tenancies are. I don't believe they're very common. And in a month-to-month tenancy, the landlord can always raise the rent. I would have trouble drafting the one-year no rent increase provision to make an exception for getting a property tax increase. I think part of I got warned that you might have that issue. So I gave that a little bit of thought. And my first thought was, gosh, doesn't everybody assume that taxes go up every year? So wouldn't you assume that build that into your financial model? That, gosh, I need to raise my rents, and all I need to do is give a 90-day notice?
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. I'm just curious, having lived in other states, I'm originally from Minnesota and having lived in some other states, and back in the day when I would rent apartments, everywhere I ever lived before I came to Oregon 21 years ago, I had a lease. That was my rent. That was the rent for the year. And when I moved here, and it was like month to month, and I was like, I thought, okay, well, that's kind of freeing, I guess, because then you could just leave if you wanted to leave. But it seems that so many of these issues could be solved if we just did what they do in other states, in some other states, and have a lease. So why don't we do that?
Chair Kenegar and Representative Taylor, perhaps we should amend the Oregon law to require fixed-term tenancies.
But how many states, excuse me, follow up? How many states do leases versus do month-to-month?
Chair Kenegar, Representative Taylor, I don't know. I could certainly try to figure that out. I think it's a function of the market, and whatever that market is accustomed to. For example, in Oregon, we don't have condominiums. We have co-ops. I mean, the reverse. We don't have co-ops. We have condominiums. And that's an East Coast thing. I don't know why it is that Oregon is predominantly month-to-month tenancies.
And I've heard, and this is just anecdotal, that it seems to be that more of the landlords who used to do one-year lease are moving over to month-to-month, in part because of the market.
Well, let me give you an example. Chair Kenegar, Representative Taylor. So you all were, well, I'm not sure. So in 2013, the legislature amended Oregon law to prohibit landlords from discriminating against Section 8 vouchers holders, applicants. So Section 8 HUD, which funds that program, required that the first year of the tenancy be a one-year rental agreement. What did the landlords say to us in negotiating that agreement, which they have generously helped implement since it became law? We don't like one-year rental agreements. We want you to help get the housing authorities to agree to month-to-month rental agreements. If we take a Section 8 voucher holder, we want to start off with a month-to-month tenancy. So that's, I think, an example of how landlords view month-to-month tenancies as better. Why are they better for them? They can raise the rent whenever they want, by any amount that they want, and they can terminate with a no-cause notice. In a fixed-term tenancy, you cannot terminate for no cause. You have to have a cause.
So this is partly why these, you know, protections are on the table. But I think getting back to Representative Hayden's point, what he was trying to do is make sure that landlords wouldn't – you can anticipate the 3% rise in property tax, but what about what happens in the May ballot when you might get a school bond levy?
Right.
My impression is that that would not go into effect until the following year at earliest January 1st, and you don't pay the bill until the end of that year in November. So I don't think it hits within that 12-month, but I think that's what he was getting at. And going back to the question of unintended consequences, could it be that landlords will say, well, I don't know if some big expense will come up in my life that will require me, you know, of course, if there was 1 year lease, they wouldn't be able to, but if they're on a month-to-month, they could. Will that lead some landlords to start with a higher price if they're in a, you know, knowing that they can't? That is certainly possible. But again, when I talk to the Community Alliance and tenants and others representing tenants, they feel like, you know, we will never know what all the different consequences of something are, but it's eminently more fair to say what the price is up front rather than have someone see what their paycheck is, look in Craigslist, pay for application fees, relocation, double rent, moving in, first and last month deposit, and then 3 months later get a rent increase. That, you know, if a landlord is going to react by saying, well, I better put in a buffer and increase it a little bit, that's better than all of a sudden having the rent taken out from under you.
Just one final comment.
Yep.
As I read the bill, and this is not my area of expertise, but it appears to me that there's no prohibition from rent discounts, like, okay, here's your rent, but you get a 20% discount first, second, third, and fourth month.
Chair Kenegar, Representative Hayden, that's true. Practical experience is when the market is more favorable to tenants, so when the vacancy rates are higher, you will see discounts like that in the market, or no security deposit, no last month's rent sorts of things to entice the tenant to move in.
But what we're talking about would not prohibit that.
No.
Well, any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This deserved a really robust discussion, primarily on the tenant. I'm hoping that we will move the amendments and maybe the bill on Monday. And so,
Chair, can you go?
Yes. Yeah.
I have one request. We talked about it a little bit the other day, but
could I close this? I'm going to close the public hearing, the work session on 4001 and 4143. Yes.
I have a request. Is it possible, and I don't know who that is, that we can have somebody that is an expert on the urban growth boundary to answer the question that continually comes up about the availability of land. I don't need a big formal presentation necessarily, but I'd like to know some actual facts about, you know, why we're having such a hard time having housing available and what role the urban growth boundary is that really preventing that from happening?
Yeah.
Just instead of people discussing it and thinking that that's the case, I'd like to see whether or not how real that is.
Yep.
So thank you.
So you would like Nick Mueller to diagnose the problem.
Okay. So I'm carrying over both of those bills, 4001, so that we have the inclusionary zoning vehicle if needed, and House Bill 4143, tenant protections. I am carrying those over to Monday. And with that, I believe we are adjourned.
All right.
Are adjourned.